It's taken from Matthew 11, verses 25 to 30, and it's page number 689 in the blue Bibles that you can find at the back. At that time, Jesus said, "I praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because you have hidden these things from the wise and learned and revealed them to little children. Yes, Father, for this was your good pleasure. All things have been committed to me by my Father. No one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son, and those to whom the Son chooses to reveal them. Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light."
Daily lives. It's not just the sense of being reconciled with God, which is the start of it, is really important beginning of it, but also experiencing the benefits of that reconciliation, having that very deep sense of peace and satisfaction with our lives, regardless of what's going on around us. I think that's an awesome promise. Why is it then that in our lives we often experience anything but rest? And today, let's find out together. So, three things that we will look at in this passage. The first is, why don't we have it? Then, how do we get it? And then, finally, what's the catch? And I do believe there is a catch here. Why don't we have it? Several years ago, in 2013, I had a serious burnout. I found myself in a situation when I couldn't work for a year, I couldn't study, I couldn't pretty much do anything. And I was depressed as well, tired all the time, and was very anxious and full of fear. I burnt out, and although I've lived through that experience and came out on the other side, so I returned to work a year later, but I never quite fully recovered from that. You know, my energy level even now is still not up to the same level that I had before that. And what I could not understand is, why is it that God didn't give me that sense of rest? You know, I was praying like crazy during that period. And it's like, it's right here, right? You know, I will give you rest if you come to me. Like, yeah, Jesus, I'm right here. Don't you see? I don't see that. I don't feel that rest. You know, I feel anxiety and depression. You know, what's wrong? I believe I know the answer now, but let's find out as we go through this amazing passage. In this chapter, in chapter 11, Matthew, Jesus talks about two kinds of responses to his invitation to come to him. Those who receive him and those who don't. And first, let's have a look at those who don't. He talks about the generation that refuses him first. I'll just read a few verses. Something that we talked about 2 weeks ago when Chris preached to us from this passage. But let's just refresh that in our heads. From verse 16, "But to what will I compare this generation? It's like children sitting in the marketplaces and calling to one another. We played the flute for you and you didn't dance. We wailed and you didn't mourn. For John came neither eating nor drinking, and they say he has a demon. The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say, look, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners, yet wisdom is vindicated by her deeds. Then he began to reproach the cities in which most of his deeds of power had been done, because they did not repent. Woe to you, Chorazin, woe to you, Bethsaida. For if the deeds of power done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. But I will tell you, on the day of judgment, it will be more tolerable for Tyre and Sidon than to you." Very strong words here, and there are some characteristics of that generation we can find in here. So in this whole passage, first of all, they are unrepentant of their sin. Jesus comes to them and says, "Here I am. I'm preaching the good news to you. I'm healing people. I'm preaching the message of salvation," and they refuse that. not only they are independent of their sin, they also rely on their intellect and wisdom. So in the passage today, we read that Jesus is praising the Father because he says, you have hidden these things from the wise and the intelligent and revealed them to infants. Wise and intelligent is not necessarily a bad thing. And in some other contexts, like in chapter 23, for example, Jesus tells about the prophets, the wise prophets that God sent to Israel. So, to be wise, to have intelligence is not necessarily bad. In this congregation, we have a lot of really intelligent people teaching at the universities in this little town and having, high power professions as well. So in itself, being wise and intelligent is not a bad thing. But here Jesus talks about the fact that even the best of human insight, which relies only on its own resources, cannot penetrate God's wisdom. Think about ourselves and God. Think about creation and creator, someone who's created that incredible, huge universe, and the tiny little planet somewhere kind of in the corner of the galaxy. And that is what is interesting, he says, that that's just the Father's good pleasure. That's how he chose to operate with humanity. He doesn't expect us to rely on our own resources when we come to him. He expects us to trust him. So this generation think they know best, and they also rely, they also expect God to dance to their own tune, like those children in this little story that Jesus is telling. They're telling Jesus, they're telling John the Baptist, you have to really fall under our expectations, but they just don't. God does what he wants to do. And it's interesting that, it's easy for us today, I think, to judge people of Jesus' generation. They saw him. Why didn't they all come to him? But I think this attitude actually describes something about general human condition with regards to God. We like to look for ultimate satisfaction in life in pursuing our own desires and by doing it with our own resources. There is something in us that just rejects the idea of being dependent on someone bigger than ourselves. Often it's our own resources, our intellect. We are proud, we venerate people who are self-made people. They made themselves. They're really cool. They achieved everything in life by their own strength, intellect, education they had, etc. And I don't think that tendency necessarily disappears when we, for example, become Christians. I see it in myself all the time. And when we rely on our own strength and we expect God to kind of do our will, often we use the word when to that. It's like, I will be finally peaceful and restful when we have a better job, maybe when I find a better job, when we find the right girl to marry or the right guy, when people start treating me the way I deserve, when my boss stops being an idiot, when I have enough money to retire. This one in particular has been a recent obsession of mine. Before my burnout, my unquenchable drive was to become successful in my career. But after I got through the burnout, I was actually willing to give that one up. I felt like, I don't really care anymore about becoming someone important. I know how it hurts when you hit the wall. Just give me, God, enough money to be able to be financially secure. I just want some rest and peace and have a little garden and drink coffee, and I'll serve you as well, as my time allows me. And I prayed really hard, actually, for God to give it to me. Unfortunately, these strong desires for own success, for achieving things in our own way, they put us in the state exactly opposite of rest. They put us in a state of constant unrest. When I'm driven by those kind of over desires, every time that something, anything gets in the way of that desire fulfilled, I get upset. I get anxious. I get angry. I get resentful, restless, irritable, and discontented. I'm unhappy because I'm not getting what I want there. And the real enemy, of course, here is our ego. It's self-centeredness. It's fundamental selfishness that we have, that inordinate demand for our needs and desires to be met, something that Apostle Paul later calls flesh. It's not the body. It's just that tendency. It's just that, you know, crazy desire to get what we want. And it's very much alive, I believe, when we become Christians. We reach our goals only to feel that very temporary, fleeting sense of satisfaction, and then we are off pursuing to another goal. You know, it never really satisfies, right? When you achieve the goal, when you get that job, when you get that girl, whatever. It's like it's maybe a day you enjoy it, you know, you have some wine with your friends, and then next day, okay, what's next then? What is the next thing? Because ego keeps telling us, no, that wasn't the thing. That is the thing. The next thing is the thing that's going to fulfill you. You just can't. You can't find rest by your own efforts. That really deep sense of peace and happiness and satisfaction with life. So how do we get it? And I believe that this passage gives us quite a nice formula, actually, a nice little formula. I like formulas. I'm a management consultant, so I like to package everything in kind of understandable little things. So let's see how cute this formula is and how easy it is to get that rest, get that real rest from Christ, to get from struggles of life to finding that sense of deep satisfaction. The first thing that Jesus tell us to do here is to come to me. Come to me, all who that are weary and are carrying heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. So here's a promise. So he is the reason that only Jesus can give it to us is that he has the unique relationship with his Father. He is the only one who can give it to us. So in the verse before, he says, all things have been handed to me over to my by my Father, and no one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son, and anyone to whom the Son chooses to reveal him. For us, it doesn't sound, I mean, the word Father, for example, doesn't sound particularly offensive, but actually for the Jesus says listeners and for Matthew, the readers of Gospel of Matthew, it was unheard of. Jews at that time occasionally referred to God as our Father, but never, you know, the individual would refer to God as Father. It was too disrespectful. It's like, how can I claim that God is my Father? And Jesus uses that very familiar term. Most likely in Aramaic, he uses Abba, Daddy. He has that term that implies intimacy with God. And he makes an pretty outrageous claim. I think that is pretty outrageous. That was outrageous there, and it's even more outrageous today in our politically correct society. No one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son, and anyone to whom the Son chooses to reveal. So he's not being particularly inclusive here or politically correct, but, you know, hey, he is the one who made the universe. He is the one who makes the rules. So come to Jesus because he is the only one. He has the absolute authority now and control over the universe. So he is the only one who can give you rest. It's as simple as that. And the second point here is that we need to change something about our attitude. We need to become like little children or infants, as the Greek implies here. So what is it about little children? He says, Father, thank you because you have hidden these things from the wise and the intelligent and have revealed them to infants. So the infants here are shown in contrast with the wise or intelligent. So and little children do not rely on their own resources. They don't have any. They have to constantly rely on their parents, on people outside them, and they're open to receiving help. One of the most fascinating spiritual movements of the 20th century was started by very unlikely people. They are not theologians. They were not particularly successful. Actually, it was the opposite. They were two drunks. They met in 1934 in Akron, Ohio, and Bill Wilson, one of them, was a very talented businessman. He worked as a broker in the stock exchange, but he just couldn't stop drinking. He tried everything. He made promises to his wife. He swore on the Bible. He went to psychiatric asylums. No matter what he did, he would just inevitably relapse, and he got worse and worse until eventually he pretty much lost all hope. And then Bill has a profound spiritual experience, meets another hopeless alcoholic, a doctor, a medical professional, Dr. Bob in the literature. They together started applying biblical principles to their condition. And to an amazing results. They got sober and stayed sober for the rest of their lives, and they started what's now known as Alcoholics Anonymous. Amazing story. And Alcoholics Anonymous had such a success in of recovery because the psychologists, therapists, psychiatrists of that time, they had no idea what to do with hopeless alcoholics. They just couldn't do anything to help them. And now millions of people are recovering from not just alcohol, but all sorts of addictions, applying exactly the same 12 steps, the principles there. From all sorts of addictions, you know, whether it's food, sex, gambling, whatever, you know, pick your poison, you can recover in the 12 step from that. And what is really interesting about the 12 steps? Look at step one. I'm powerless over this microphone. So the step one says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. This is the paradox of the 12 steps. You know, Bill and Bob, they found that as long as the alcoholic believes they have control over their condition, they can't get sober. To get the program, one needs to what they call hit the bottom, to reach such a point of such pain that the pain of their drinking becomes so unbearable that it breaks through their denial, and they just come to the point, it's like, I can't help myself. I can't stop. I cannot control it. I need help there. So admission of that powerlessness paradoxically leads them to the next step, and the step two goes, came to believe that the power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, and step three is made the decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. So the road to freedom starts with the admission of powerlessness. And it's interesting that if you read the literature carefully, it's not just about stopping drinking, it's about surrendering to God your entire life. When alcoholic gets sober, according to AA, it's just the beginning of their journey. To stay sober, they need to make a complete makeover of their lives. Otherwise, they'll just be a dry drunk, the same irritable, restless, and discontented person, only without alcohol. And it all starts with acknowledgement you are powerless. You are powerless over alcohol. You are powerless over your entire life. You can't run your own life. You need God's help in everything. So that's the first step, being powerless, like children. And this, the second thing about children is that they totally trust their parents, don't they? If they're really small infants, they just have no choice. They just trust their parents here. They're confident that their parents love them. How about Jesus? And we can actually trust Jesus not only because of his absolute power over the universe, but also because of his character. And here he says that he is gentle and humble in heart. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you'll find rest for your soul. So there is something about the character of Jesus that makes us trust him. We can actually trust him. He is not an evil, angry master. We can rely on his character. And he is so committed to us that he eventually chose to die a brutal death on the cross for us. So, admitting you're powerless and trusting Jesus is the way to rest, right? It sounds kind of too simple, you know, there must be a catch somewhere. And I believe there is one. So let's again read this final three verses. Come to me, all that are weary and are carrying heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. Jesus says, take my yoke here. What is the yoke that he is referring to? The yoke that Jesus is referring to is essentially submitting to God your entire life and living it as he requires. The yoke, the metaphor of the yoke here is he most likely implies here a single human yoke. It's something that helps us to carry heavy loads if you put it on your neck. And the metaphor of yoke implies obedience. Even slavery, in some contexts in the Bible, uses slavery. It doesn't necessarily have to be a negative thing, but it does imply total and full obedience. And at this point, it might actually seem really unfair. It's like, wait a minute, why would I accept anyone's yoke? I am free, right, to choose to live my life as I am. But are we really? The truth is that we are already slaves. That's why we are burdened and weary in the first place. Well, with active alcoholics and addicts, it's just more obvious. Their lives fall apart very quickly. But aren't we all dependent on something or someone in our lives? It doesn't have to be like a gross, terrible sin. It could be like good things. You know, children, career, financial independence, reputation, ambition. What is the most important thing in your life? What do you live for? That is your yoke. That controls you, that requires you to live a life on its terms. And if you don't get it, the moment you don't get it, the moment things go wrong, you lose that very fragile and self-manufactured temporary sense of peace, don't you? I know I do. So we really can't live without a yoke. It's a myth. It's a modern myth that we can be totally free. But the only thing we can actually do is to choose which yoke to wear. The one that really tires us, makes us anxious and fearful, drives us to despair, or the one that Jesus offers us. And there is something really cool about that yoke, I believe. Unlike the yoke of the scribes that Jesus talks about later in chapter 23, this yoke brings not weariness but rest for your souls. It's a yoke that makes your burdens light. And there is something really interesting about this yoke. My yoke is kind and my burden is light. In most Bible translations, when we read this, it says my yoke is easy. But actually, the Greek word is used here is Christos, which is very often used as a personal attribute, as kind or good, like, you know, God is good or God is kind or kind person. It's a very unusual term to actually use with an inanimate object. So it's like the end of the metaphor, right? Jesus is referring to himself. My yoke is kind. And my burden is light. Compared to the stuff that you're already carrying, if you take my yoke, if you choose to be obedient to me, actually, you'll feel way better than trying to carry your own yoke. Taking up his yoke means surrendering yourself to God fully and obeying him. And paradoxically, if we accept his authority, his slavery even, we become truly free. We'll have that internal freedom and sense of peace. But that's not the only catch we have here. So take your yoke. There is another one here. Learn to be humble. So here's what Jesus says. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart. He is humble, and he wants us to learn from him, from the character of their master. This corresponds very well to the shocking values of the kingdom of God that Jesus talks about earlier in the Sermon on the Mount, chapters 5 to 7. He says that blessed are people who are poor in spirit, people who realize their total inadequacy to live their lives in their own strength. Blessed are the meek, not the powerful and important. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, not those who hunger for glory or financial security. Humility is a prerequisite to finding that rest. And again, I want to refer back to Bill Wilson, and in one of his writings in 12 steps, on step 7 actually, when we talk about we humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings, he talks about humility. I'll read a few sentences from that. For us, the process of gaining a new perspective was unbelievably painful. It was only by repeated humiliations that we were forced to learn something about humility. It was only at the end of the long road, marked by successive defeats and humiliations and the final crushing of our self-sufficiency, that we began to feel humility as something more than a condition of groveling despair. To get completely away from our aversion to the idea of being humble, to gain a vision of humility as the avenue to true freedom of the human spirit, to be willing to work for humility as something to be desired for itself, takes most of us a long, long time. And then later he says, by this time, in all probability, we have gained some measure of release from our more devastating handicaps. We enjoy moments in which there is something like real peace of mind. To those of us who have hitherto known only excitement, depression, or anxiety, in other words, to all of us, this newfound peace is a priceless gift. Something new indeed has been added. Where humility had formerly stood for a force feeding on humble pie, it now begins to mean the nourishing ingredient which can give us serenity. Humility, that acceptance of life on life's terms, acceptance of our own limitations, acceptance of other people as they are, acceptance when God is saying no to us, is key to rest. You can't arrive to the state of resting for your soul unless you learn humility. You know, that burnout that I had actually taught me an important lesson. At that time, it wasn't Jesus' yoke I was carrying. It was my own. A year before my burnout, I decided I needed to get another postgraduate degree to advance my career. I decided to do it part-time. And my demand for success, you know, getting that prestigious degree was so strong that I ignored some simple facts. For example, that I already have a very demanding full-time job, which requires me to travel to London almost every day, takes 50, 60 hours a week. I ignored the fact that I had a family, a wife and two small children who required my care and attention. And I ignored the fact that there was only 24 hours a day. I didn't pray for it. You know, the moment I saw the opportunity, I just snatched it. The way I used to do things in my life, I just snatched it, entered the program, and a year later I hit the wall. I just couldn't do it anymore. I was done. There was no humility in there. There was just me trying to push my will and at the same time kind of, you know, get some help, a little help from God, you know, a little help from my friend. And I totally misunderstood the promise of rest that Jesus gave me in this passage. You know, I cannot act foolishly against God's will and then expect God to give me rest. You know, Jesus is not a spiritual painkiller. I think this is an amazing passage. It gives us a formula that we can practice daily. So what's the formula there? We encounter struggles in life. We want to find some rest. You know, I'm just tired. I can't do this anymore. What can we do? We could come to Jesus. That's the first step. And then there is a catch. We need to actually submit to him fully our lives, you know, all areas of our lives, completely surrender, and learn some humility from him. Learn that precious quality that gives us that rest. And then he says, you will find rest. And that surrender to God has to be a daily choice. It's not something that we just do once and we become a Christian, it's all great, I'll just remain the same person as I was, expect the same things from God. No, it doesn't work like that, right? So the formula is simple, but it's not easy to do. It does something to us, to the very core of our being, to the very core of our motivations and drives in life. What does it mean for us in our daily living? Tomorrow we'll get back to living our lives in the real world. Tomorrow some of us may not get that promotion that we worked really hard for. Maybe our grown-up children will make seriously wrong choice in life. Maybe our spouse will not give us the kind of affection we expect from them. Maybe we'll have to face a serious financial insecurity issue or illness. But what Jesus promises here is that we can still have his rest in the middle of all things happening around us if we surrender to his will. I'd like us to spend a couple of minutes now in reflection and prayer. And two questions I want you to think about is that, what is the yoke you are carrying right now? And the second question is, what is it that you need to surrender to find that rest? Just pray silently for a couple of minutes and then I'll finish. Of rest, Lord, it's so precious. I'm very grateful that I have this promise from you. And I can rely on your word. You never lie. You will give me rest if I surrender to your will, take your yoke, and learn humility from you, Jesus. I want to give to you all the desires of my heart, all the needs that I have, Lord, and it's up to you whether you will fulfill them or not. I can't control it, Lord. I ask you to grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen.